Radio Netherlands, the home of high frequency since 1927.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
This is the shortwave station at Hilversum, Holland, the son of PCJJ. And it's time to gather round four. Antique Wireless Revisited. Introduced by Jonathan Marks.
Hello. In this part of Western Europe, the hobby of collecting and restoring old radio receivers is catching on. One in 10,000 Dutchmen is a collector, and over in Britain, nearly 2,000 people are thought to be actively involved in searching for bits of the past. In a previous programme, we looked at two collectors in the Netherlands who concentrated on military surplus radios from World War II. This time we're focusing specifically on domestic valve or tube radios of the 1920s, 30s and 40s. Quite a few museums exist across this continent, but we chose to visit one collection which is more than just a row of silent polished cabinets. Most of the radios in the collection of the British Vintage Wireless Society still perform today. With specimens collected from all over Europe, the museum is in a large house in the suburbs of South London. Gerald Wells is the man in charge, and when we arrived for a tour, he took us first into a large garden workshop with shelves full of old radios. Each has its own history, and seeing the polished cabinets brings back a flood of old memories.
Bakelite was a lovely substance. You get some beautiful cabinets. It was cheap and easy to make, and it came out of a mould with a perfect shine on it.
The problem I would have thought with this early form of plastic, the Bakelite, is that it cracks quite easily, doesn't it?
Only if you drop it. It was remarkably tough, certainly as tough as the present-day plastics. That's in my opinion. Obviously, you couldn't bounce them around too much, but they stood heat. They didn't like sunlight too much. Ultraviolet did quite a lot of damage to them, took a shine off them. But you'd always put it back with some 3-in-1 oil and some good old polish.
What about the other cabinets, or the earlier cabinets?
Well, pre-Bakelite ones, like these are wooden ones, they were quite often veneered on the front and left plain on the sides. In fact, some of them, like the Kosser sets, the veneer was photographed on. It was a plain birch ply, it would have been subjected to some photographic substance, shown to a rather nice piece of wood, and then polished.
Really? So actually a photographed cover?
Yes. It was marvellous until you got a scratch on it and you tried to rub the scratch out and you found yourself back on bare plywood. Then it was a paint box job. The better manufacturers, more quality firms like Murphy's and HMV's and Bush, you could take quite a scraping off a cabinet if a cabinet got severely damaged, like that one had been. Or you could scrape it all off and then re-French polish and it would come up as new.
And what sort of material was used for those?
Well, that's walnut veneer on ply. Most of them was plywood. They hadn't invented chipboard or ticky-tacky then, which is sort of highly developed Weetabix.
And how many different manufacturers are represented here?
About 100 in the whole establishment.
And what's the biggest collection, biggest make?
Well, Philips, I'd say. Well, they're probably one of the best, so obviously they've lasted. The nastier ones, I don't like mentioning names, but I can point you in the right direction. Well, Ironmonger could pick up his radios from the same place he got his nails from, the same wholesaler. Radio trade didn't really recognise them. And some radio trade wouldn't even sell at all and were assigned to the furniture shops. And they got known as furniture shop sets.
Curiously, the older the receiver, the better it's made, partly because the saturation of the radio market in Europe in later years led to some rather drastic economies. Still, switching on any of these sets and having to wait for the tubes or valves to warm up has much more of a charm than today's modern digital creations. They also warm the room on a cold evening.
¶¶
Right, you've also got a very large valve or tube collection in front of us here. Anything special about these valves?
Yes, there's one or two unusual ones, apart from this nice little fur-lined box containing three R-type valves from the First World War. They were put into these cases because they were so valuable, they thought they'd put them in a jewel box. Then, of course, there's a famous Lerva, which was, I suppose you could say, the forerunner of a silicon chip or integrated circuit. It had three triodes in one glass, coupled together with suitable components, all in one. So all you had to do was put a valve on a chassis, couple it up to a coil, a loudspeaker and battery supplies, and you had a complete wireless set.
What happened if one of the components went wrong? That was tough luck.
Just very tough luck. And they'd soon supply you with a new valve, or they'd take the valve back to the factory and rebuild it for a very small fee. This was bought in because of our wonderful valve holder tax we had in this country in the 20s and 30s and 40s, where a tax of 12 and sixpence or something was put on each valve in the set, or each holder. So if they could bring out a multiple valve, it cut the cost down tremendously. Fortunately, the valve holder tax was out of the way before television and radar got well underway. Otherwise, we'd never have had it at all.
I can imagine. When did the idea of a magic eye get into radios?
Round about, as far as I can tell, I'm not accurate on this, I'd say 1935-36. It was a lovely help to sell radio sets. The market was already saturated, and they hadn't invented a push button yet, so the magic eye was a good stopgap to help sell the sets. It did help tuning, but actually your ears were a better guide as to whether you're on station or not. You didn't need a visual aid.
Why are the American valves blue?
Well, the system we used for firing them left the valves brown inside. And as everybody knew that a valve that had gone brown inside was probably soft or useless, the Americans wouldn't buy them. So they decided to make the glass blue, and they couldn't see that the firing was brown. It showed up silver. In fact, even after they'd stopped using whatever it was that turned the firing brown, they still carried on using a blue glass. And now, of course, they're very valuable.
These European ones here, can you also tell from the colour of a valve whether it's any good?
Not really. Only if it's gone milky or very brown inside, then you know there's something nasty. But if it's nice and shiny and black like that, you can be pretty sure it's still got... there's still some hope for it, provided the filament and the emission is all right.
Now, none of these valves are made anymore. In fact, some of them have been out of circulation for decades. So what happens if you're restoring a radio and you need the original parts?
Well, we carry 35,000 valves on the premises over four valve stores, and we've set up a valve laboratory here with the help of Marconi Osrams and Mullards, and hoping to make our own very early types of valves. Mind you, we'll have to be early and we have to be very, very simple.
This group of restorers has gained the respect of enthusiasts across the world, and television companies too, who often loan sets when they're making dramas, set some 40 or 50 years ago.
Times are coming, coming your way. Times are coming, hear us while we say. It's a pleasure to dispense correct time with our compliments. Times are coming, coming your way.
What about the Philco name? Was that anything to do with Philips?
No, it does sound rather similar, but actually it was a Philadelphia storage company. They were an American company which was making batteries, probably at the turn of the century, and decided to have a go at radios, and did it very successfully, and was certainly one of the largest in the United States.
Who were the sort of people making receivers in the early 20s and 30s? Were they companies set up specifically to make radios?
Well, to start with, you had the founder companies of the BBC, like the GEC, Western Electric, MacMichael, Burndepts, Marconi Osrams, people like that. They were the only ones that could actually make radios, but the nearest to them, of course, was the motor trade. The motor trade could already wind coils, make knobs, panels, and do simple wiring and assembly. So it was only a short step for them to make radio sets. So you had firms like AJS, BSA, Austin, Coventry Climax, Sunbeam, Lotus, you know, all churning out radio sets. So that's why you get so many radio sets with motoring names on.
How did Philips get into it?
Well, Philips were an electric lamp company in Holland, and they were making light bulbs to the early part of this century. Somebody came along and asked them if they could make some light bulbs with extra electrodes in, hence radio valves. And I think they called it the Deezit 1 and the Deezit 2. It's all in the little Philips booklet somewhere. And they found that there was a market for these things, so they started doing it seriously. And it grew and it grew, and Philips Radio came into its own well and truly in the early 20s, and we started turning out radios. I mean, we're doing it slightly more solid and slightly better than everybody else. We built in safety factors for main sets, so if you lifted the lid up or took the back off, the set shut down. You couldn't get a shock off it. I've had Philips sets here that were made in 1928, and I've plugged them in and they've still worked, and they've been sitting in a loft for maybe 40 years.
What about the battery manufacturers?
Well, they also started to make radios. Vidor, of course, was Burndept. Burndept got into difficulties making radios and batteries and things in 1930-odd. He had closed down, so he reopened again using the names of his daughters, Violet and Doris, and called it Vidor.
What about Eveready?
Well, they were turning out these monstrosities in the early 30s, probably before, and they're still going strong. Along with Vidors, I'd say they were probably the biggest manufacturer.
No wonder battery manufacturers made radios. You needed a total of three different batteries in most sets of the day.
You had a 2-volt accumulator, which was usually a wet variety, which had to be charged up every week. 120-volt high-tension battery with tappings on it for the different valve stages, plus a tapped grid bias battery, which was tapped from 0 to 9 volts. So you would get the correct bias on the valves. And that, of course, controlled the amount of current pulled from a high-tension battery. So if you've got all your balances right, your grid bias battery would last a couple of years, your HT battery 3 months, and your accumulator a week if you were lucky.
Was that the reason why they were rechargeable?
Oh, yes, they were rechargeable, and everybody had two accumulators, one being charged and one in use.
This is a strange-looking radio. It's a blue metal cabinet, completely round, and it's called a saucepan radio.
That's right. They called a saucepan radio because it looks rather like a saucepan, and it was made for the African market. Immediately after the war, there was a bit of a problem as to who was going to get into Africa for propaganda purposes, whether it was going to be the English, the Russians, the Belgians, or the French. So we thought, if we could subject them to world service, it was big enough and strong enough all over the country, we stood a good chance. So the Eveready Company and the Cossa Company set out with two different models. Eveready's their blue saucepan radio and Cossa with their Peak Freens. Cossa, as they called it, was made in a Peak Freens biscuit tin. Both the sets were designed so that creepy crawlies, termites and anything else wouldn't get in. It was more or less spear-proof as well, just in case the set said the wrong things.
I noticed on the Bakelite knob there that indeed you can find BBC very clearly marked. Accra, Johannesburg, Lusaka, Johannesburg again, Lorenzo Marx. Right, and it's obviously a shortwave radio.
Oh, yes, it was basically shortwave, although I think some of them did have medium wave as well, yes. This was purely from 25 to 90 metre band.
Right, I've got you now. And it worked on a battery?
Yes, it worked on a large Eveready B136 battery, which was about 7 inches long by 4x4, fairly solid, and provided something didn't get in and eat it, it would probably last for 3 or 4 months.
I've got you. So it provided 90 volts for the valves. And what sort of design was it? A TRF?
Oh, no, it was a superhet circuit using the then new range of miniature valves that had come out just after the war. And they were very reliable and very sensitive, so they stood a very good chance of getting reasonable reception out there.
Oh, tape recording there, and 78s.
Oh, yes, a large collection of 78s. We carry about 4,000. Nothing particularly valuable, but mostly dance music of the 20s, 30s and 40s. Put them onto tape up this end on this sort of lo-fi music centre, and then take them down the other end and push them through our tiny little pirate radio station of about half a watt, and then I can tune the radios into 350 metres and get the right sort of programme coming out of the right sort of radio.
Let's turn it up.
The sweetest thing, what else on earth could ever be?
And so outside, across the lawn to another wooden shed. It's a beautiful day. Right, this is the laboratory.
This is lab two. We've got two laboratories. This is number two laboratory. We're setting it up for manufacture of R-type valves.
What do you mean by R-type?
Well, they were the first ones that the French invented in 1916, 1917, and we used them in trenches in France to supplement the crystal detectors that they had up to that time, and they gave amplification and better and more reliable detection.
What does R stand for, radio?
Radio receiving, yes.
So you've got a problem here, first of all, making them to the correct size, and then, of course, getting the vacuum.
Yes, blowing the glass is going to be a problem. That's something you've got to learn about. Getting the vacuum is no difficulty. We've been given all the plant by Marconi Osrams, and here we have the oil diffusion pump, the backing pump, and the pumping stems, and the Penning and Pirani gauges so we can measure the vacuum. We can get that done. That's rigged. The spot welder is putting the electrodes together, mostly made out of nickel and other semi-precious metals, tungsten wire filaments. This is a glass lathe for putting the two halves of a glass in so a valve can be turned simultaneously and joined together with a small flame.
Right, OK. Go outside again. If you lived in Holland, Britain, Belgium or France during the 1930s, then this will be familiar. How's that done?
Well, that's taken off a bit of off-air programme. There's very little Radio Normandy material on tape or on record. We managed to get hold of a little bit of it, plus some of our advertising material, and we lifted the chime straight off that, put it on a tape loop, and built it into our music control system.
Now, are people collecting because they like old radios, or are they collecting because it's a good investment?
There's a few that are doing it for good investment because they know the stuff is going to get more valuable, but there's a lot of them are trying to recapture bits of their childhood. They're usually searching for the sort of radio that they can remember winking and blinking in the corner when they were small children.
This huge Philips radio must be the largest radio in your collection?
Oh, it is the largest, yes. This was a 50-watt Gram only that Philips is producing about 1932. It was for records only, and it is an outstanding piece of workmanship. Unfortunately, somebody banged the inside full of modern hi-fi and threw the innards away, but we've still got the case from a loudspeaker, and it will live again when Philips has come up with a right service manual.
Is it difficult getting hold of old service manuals?
Not too bad. We've been very lucky so far. Stacks of them have been given to us by different manufacturers and collectors and service workshops, so we've built up a very good library.
And so the tour continues upstairs. The Murphy radio, that's after Frank Murphy, is that correct?
After Frank Murphy, who was a very clever businessman and wanted to produce a first-class radio. He wasn't too worried about the cabinet at first. He wanted something that would last. By 1930, so many people had got on a bandwagon and were producing rubbish. It was loads of bang, squeaks and whistles and wasn't good. So he produced a first-class AC mains radio, built like a battleship. It was built to last forever. In fact, they're still lasting, still all working. In fact, their first model there, the mains A3, is still working and working well. His designs were outrageous. You either loved them or you hated them.
How do you define vintage? Because obviously you can go back until early radios began. How late do you go?
Well, basically here, not much beyond 1940. Partly because of space, and partly because after that it got boring.
What's the earliest Philips that you've got?
I'd say it was this thing here, which is the first main set. It's a lovely, solid, chunky, five-valve mains receiver in full working order. It was fished off a skip, rusty, rotten, and some yob had put his foot through the speaker. But we plugged it in and it worked. So that's not bad for a 1928 set.
Now, Philips is a Dutch company. Were they all made in Holland or were they made in the UK as well?
No. Philips is paired up with Stanley Mullard, which gave him an entree into this country, and we started manufacturing stuff over here in, I'd say, the late 20s. And most things had PM written on it, like all the valve numbers, like PM2, PM3, which meant Philips Mullard.
When did the Superhit design really come in?
Well, the Superhit was invented in the early years of this century, but it was impractical, it distorted and it whistled like blazes, so nobody would use it seriously till about 1933. In fact, Philips's didn't like it very much at all and didn't use it till 1934-35. They stuck to their superinductance circuit, which was, I think, far superior to the Superhit for quality and station selectivity.
And how long would valves last?
Well, this set here was made in, say, 1934, and it's got its original valves in it, but it's still going strong. Valves were far more reliable than people gave them credit for. It was always for small parts, for condensers and resistances that went, and transformers that went in radios more than the valves. But as the valves were most expensive, they were the ones you got charged for when your set went wrong. So everybody thought valves had gone. Half the time it wasn't.
What's the most difficult part to replace, apart from valves?
Knobs, dials, speaker escutcheons, speaker cloth.
What about the old metal condensers? Because you can't find those anymore.
Well, we just refill the old ones. There's plenty of modern ones around, which will fit inside the old cans and look exactly like the right part. As long as you write on them that it's reproduction and what you've done, and you're not trying to deceive anybody.
Indeed, some collectors have been fooled by clever fakes. But those telltale components, like the speaker fabric and the Bakelite knobs, usually make it easier to identify the genuine article. What's amusing is to see how history is repeating itself.
When radio first started, we had umpteen boxes. We had a box for batteries, we had a box for a tuner, the amplifier, maybe two stages of amplifier, the loudspeaker. When the electric turntable came along and the electric pickup, we had another box for that. Then somebody had the bright idea of putting the tuner, the amplifier and the power supply all in one box. Make all little wireless set and had a separate speaker. By 1930, somebody thought, what a wonderful idea to stick the loudspeaker in the same box as a wireless. And then somebody thought, why not put it in a bigger box with a speaker, the amplifier, tuner, power supply, and the turntable, and we call it a radiogram. This was marvellous, and this lasted until 1950, when somebody said, why not invent the hi-fi, and we'll put the tuner in one box, the amplifier in another box, the power supply in another box, the turntable, and another box, and the speaker in another box. We were quite happy with that until 1960. Then along came somebody who said, why not invent a music centre and put the tuner, the amplifier, the power supply and the turntable in one box and we'll call it a music centre. We still have a speaker separate. I'm waiting for them to invent a radiogram.
And next to that huge Murphy radiogram, there's another giant cabinet, this time from Philips. In the middle is a rather curious-looking control knob. Today's computer enthusiasts would probably call it a joystick.
Yes, so would aircraft people. It is the mono knob. It was a Philips's were famous for this. It was a bane of every engineer ever existed. It was done on a series of Bowden cables and wires, and if it went wrong, it was a nightmare. Many got smashed to bits, thrown out of windows and jumped on. This one does need treatment, but it's worked by moving the knob up and down. You can change alter the volume, side to side, you can alter the tone, and if you twist it round and round, you can actually move a tuning pointer. So it's all done on one knob. This was to counteract the earlier sets, which looked rather like the control panel of a Concorde, knobs in every direction.
Let's go next door to the portables. Okay, obviously early radios were large and were designed for tabletop use. When did the idea of a portable radio come in?
Well, portable radios came in almost as soon as the big ones. It was very fashionable to have your suitcase portable and take it on the running board of your car out into the country and listen to dance music while you're having a picnic.
And also, not only the British stations, but at Radio Normandy, I guess.
Well, Radio Normandy was one of your first commercial radio stations, I mean, of course, there was Radio Lyons, and of course, Radio Luxembourg was going to this day. Radio Normandy and Lyons obviously closed down when war broke out, and they were received very well in this country.
But looking at the dials, I mean, did they really represent what you could pick up, or were some of them...
If you had the right conditions and followed the instructions, a good aerial and a good earth, when most stations were broadcasting, you could pick them up without any shadow of a doubt. In fact, you can today. Slightly different positions, but they're all there.
This is a funny-looking thing. It looks like a Bakelite handbag.
It does. This is made by GECs. They were very impractical to change the batteries in. It's split apart like an Easter egg, and... it was very, very heavy, but had a nice big speaker in it. And you only had to drop it once, and it was a dustpan and brush job.
Imagine a radio inside a chrome ball mounted on top of a pipe. It exists.
Now, here's a very strange radio. It looks like a silver sphere on a stand.
Yeah, it's a famous Emor globe, commonly known as the overgrown ashtray. The sound comes out of the top. It was bought out in 1946, and I'm sure it's made out of a chromed Belisha beacon sections. And a bit of gas, a few bits of gas pipe, and a Perspex dial around it. It's made out of all ex-government stuff, and the firm didn't last very long. They now sell for enormous prices. Mind you, in 1946, chrome balls on sticks weren't particularly welcome. We wanted something in a square box that worked. Oh, I found a grown-up station.
And you tune it by turning the sphere around.
Yes, you've got these metal sleeves on the pipe. You turn around to alter the volume of wave change, and you turn the ball itself to change the stations. By some miracle, the light stands still and the globe goes round.
And has it got shortwave as well?
Oh, it's got shortwave on it. Mind you, it'd be impossible to tune because your tuning is far too coarse.
Right, down to
11:45. The skies were overcast in the northwest of the country with rain locally. It was moderate elsewhere.
Radio Polonia. Well, a small dedicated group of people helped Gerald restore an ever-growing number of early sets. And not only men either. Several girls come round to sort through piles of surplus capacitors and resistors donated by manufacturers, clearing out their cellars. But what do the neighbours think of all this?
Well, they love the place. Whenever we have open days, they do the catering, they take the fences down, we use their gardens, they let me build across their land. And they've been the most marvellous neighbours either side. Mind you, people across the road don't know we're here. They think we're a clinic. Because they see people in white coats and girls going in and out, and occasionally me standing out the gate with a cat in my arms. So I just fool them. Mind you, the other side of the world, they know we're here.
Right, indeed, marvellous. Well, thank you very much indeed for showing us around.
It's a pleasure. Hope you'll come again.
I was talking there to Gerald Wells.
That's all for now. Input on our output to Media Network, Box 222, Hilversum, Holland.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. It's, some people get static, some people get far-off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon.
Bye for now.